Hello, and welcome to this podcast miniseries on coastal resilience in the face of climate change. I'm Josephine Anselin. I'm a PhD student at the University of Cambridge, and I'm currently doing a policy internship at the Centre for Science and Policy here in Cambridge. Through this podcast series, I'm hoping to shed some light on coastal resilience, a topic that has been close to my heart ever since witnessing coastal management issues firsthand while living in Jakarta, Indonesia's capital city, which has also been referred to as the world's fastest sinking city. In each episode of the podcast, I'll be talking to a different coastal research expert. And together, we'll explore a specific aspect of the UK's coastal adaptation to climate change. We'll discuss some of the latest science, the links between academic research and policy, as well as steps that academics can take to help bridge the gap between coastal science and policy action. For the first episode of this series, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Robert Nichols to talk about what coastal resilience is and how it can be measured. Professor Nichols is based at the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at the University of East Anglia. He has a long experience of analysing long-term coastal problems, and much of his work has focused on sea level rise and climate change. He has advised national governments and intergovernmental organisations on climate change and coastal issues, and he was also a lead author to 5 reports of the IPCC assessment process. So without further ado, let's get into this conversation. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to have this conversation and to share your expertise. So you've been involved in many different projects related to coastal adaptation. And I'd like to start by asking you, what has personally motivated you to become involved in this area of research?
Well, I suppose I started off my career very much in the kind of physical realm. I was doing coastal engineering, looking at coastal erosion, actually, was really the topic of my PhD. And that kind of, though, as time went on, I started to, sea level rise came in as an issue. And that sort of started to really bring in the notion of people and coastal systems, rather than just thinking about the coast as a physical system. And I found that very, very rewarding. And so I suppose my work naturally kind of gravitated. And I find this issue of looking at how people can coexist with the sort of physical coast a very interesting topic, and clearly a very relevant topic because hundreds of millions of people are affected by these issues.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And it's always really interesting to hear about what's the path that people have taken to get to where they are. So given your kind of wide range of experiences, there are many kind of directions that this conversation could take and many themes we could touch on. But one of the projects that I'd like to focus on in today's conversation, because of its relevance to the topic of this episode, is the NERC Coastal RES project, for which you were PI a few years ago. So could you please give a brief overview of the objectives and also the motivations for this project?
Well, I suppose the objective of the project really was to really see how we could, if you like, operationalize the notion of coastal resilience. As people have talked about adaptation, the word resilience has sort of slipped into use quite widely. And we felt that at times that was rather fuzzy, and we wanted to take a look at the issue of coastal resilience and see how we could sort of operationalize it, really, or can we operationalize it, and what would that actually sort of mean in practice. So that was really, that's the overall goal. It was quite a small project, but I think we managed to make quite a lot of progress in that regard.
Okay. So when you say operationalize, do you mean, what exactly do you mean? Do you mean like defining it or measuring it? Or...
Well, I think the word coastal, the word resilience and then coastal resilience, maybe a sort of subset of that, is used quite widely. I would say, You mentioned the notion of definition. Actually, there's often resilience is used without a definition. And we did a in the Coastal Res project, we did a content analysis, one of my colleagues, of government reports. And it was, the word resilience was used sometimes, many times, and yet it was never defined.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, it's not getting at government reports. I think it was, it's quite a widespread problem that it was a bit of a motherhood and apple pie concept, because who could not want resilience? It's resilience. Yeah. Sounds like a good thing to have, doesn't it? But what do you mean by that? So operationalization, I think, is about defining, but also using, or at least the potential to use it in as a practical management concept.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So based on that project, based on the findings, what did you, like, which sort of definition did you come up with to clarify what coastal resilience is? And how does this actually differ from the more traditional kind of risk-based coastal management approach?
Well, I suppose really, I mean, let's just think about resilience as a concept. Most probably, why has resilience come along? I think because it's probably a system concept that's quite useful. It's about the ability to bounce back, literally. And so it has the notion of the stress, if you like, you know, in a coastal context, that might be the storm. That would probably be the stress that we're worried about in terms of coastal flooding. But then also, how can we respond and bounce back from that event? And I think traditional, if you like, coastal defense is all about avoiding damage. Even coastal risk management traditionally really is still focusing on that event and how do we avoid the event. Resilience is thinking more about the system over time. So the damaging events will happen, but it also acknowledges that at times they're going to cause harm. And how will you be able to bounce back from that? And also potentially learn and maybe get to a different and better place than you were before. So it also, again, it depends how you define it, but implicit in that is the opportunity to learn and to improve rather than just to return to where you were, which probably is not necessarily the best goal, because often we might say we're not ideally adapted today. So we'd like to take these shocks as an opportunity maybe to improve and learn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so earlier you mentioned seawalls kind of as an example of an approach that could be used to, you know, more of a risk-based coastal management approach. So just to kind of further illustrate this concept of resilience, could you give maybe one or two examples of policy options that would be available to enhance coastal resilience?
Policies that could enhance resilience, I think, are multifold, because they can be about your ability to actually deal with an event. So, you know, a seawall or a levee can add to your resilience, particularly assuming that it works and the defence keeps you dry during the event. Equally, if you do get maybe a flood and areas are damaged, policies that could actually help you recover. So the policies that might allow and facilitate rebuilding of an area afterwards, that's another policy that could enhance resilience. And I suppose I should have said this at the beginning, warnings, knowing that something bad is coming is also very, very important. So now we have very good warning and forecast facilities that tell us storms are coming. They're no longer a surprise. And so that also allows us to be ready and prepared for events. So it's about being ready for the event, knowing the event's coming, having actions to take when the event happens, and being able to recover after the event. So it means a suite of different types of policies need to be there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so one of the, like, aside from defining coastal resilience, another output of the Coastal Res project was to try and come up with a model or a way to quantify or measure coastal resilience. So before we actually talk about the methodology that you proposed, could you just briefly explain why it's so important to be able to quantify coastal resilience?
I was saying earlier that resilience can come across as a sort of motherhood and apple pie kind of concept. Who could not want resilience? But what is it? And I think, so therefore, if you're going to use resilience in a management sense, you've got to be able to define it and you've got to be able to measure it. Is resilience going up? Is it going down? Is it staying the same? These are the kinds, if you're a manager, you have to have some sense of what are the trends in resilience. Otherwise, it's essentially not a very useful management concept. So I think all in management, I think you have to be able to assess the trends in your indicators in some sense. That could be semi-quantitative. Here we were trying to do it in a fully quantitative way.
Yeah, definitely. It would probably be very helpful as well in terms of knowing where to prioritize initiatives or efforts.
Absolutely. I mean, we live in a world of finite resources. So one of the questions might be, you know, I've got a certain amount of money. How can I spend that to maximize the gains in resilience so that you can actually look at where that money can be best spent?
Yeah. Okay. So what are actually the actual components or the systems that need to be taken into account when trying to quantify coastal resilience?
Well, I think one of the things to note really is there's maybe not an absolute notion of resilience. I think resilience, just like risk really, to some extent is a human construction. We have the physical quantities of the world, but we also have our views about them. So there's a kind of there's a value aspect to this about what we think is important. And I think if you think back to, you know, say go back to your parents or maybe your grandparents, or maybe you didn't know them, but your great grandparents, they had different values. Each generation has different values, and our children and our grandchildren will also have different values. So these notions of resilience or risk, they evolve with time. So what we did was we also made a point about saying we need to link to today's world. So what we did was also say let's look at the defenses that exist today. Let's look at the policies that exist today, and let's imagine that we can. How can we build on that? Rather than sort of sometimes I find people with resilience almost kind of tear up what's been done before and say everything's been wrong, we need to start again. We were incrementally building on what had been done, and so therefore we looked at a number of different indicators. We looked at the area that was flooded. For example, the coastal floodplain. And then we looked at various, you know, we looked at how many people were living there. We looked at the issues around ecosystems. We looked at issues around the economy. And we used data sets that existed so that we could build a sort of GIS database of the UK coast. And then we could sort of aggregate that into different metrics for assessment of resilience. And what we assessed a number of different factors. I won't list them all here, but what we did was we took really a sort of an environmental a social, if you like, and a sort of physical perspective of the coast, and we actually then did some valuation, just basically expert judgment of what would different perspectives value about the coast. So you know, if you take an environmental perspective, and that you take that as the most important perspective. You would value, say, your habitats more than if you're thinking maybe about a sort of a economic view of the coast, which might be more human-centric, just for example.
Ah, that's interesting. So that means that depending on your perspective or depending on the factor you want to put more emphasis on, you could come up with a different coastal resilience score.
Absolutely. I think that's, I said it's socially constructed, really. So I think maybe this is one of the learnings. I mean, I don't think, again, this model was really designed to illustrate the thinking of coming up with a quantification. I mean, I said we were looking at how we could operationalize this. We're not saying we're going to come up with the answer. We're just showing you this is the kind of process that you'd have to go through to come up with something that we agree on. But it, to actually come up with this process that everybody agrees on, we're going to have a lot of discussions, a lot of learning about what we value and how we can measure it. And actually discussions probably about our fundamental values, actually. I think looking at resilience actually opens up a bit of, to some people might be a can of worms, because you have to really think quite hard about what you want, how you might achieve it.
That's interesting. And it just highlights as well that depending on the government's priorities, different areas may be prioritized when it comes to coastal resilience.
One interesting thing is the issue in government of boundaries between government, because when you think about the ability, I mean, typically DEFRA and the Environment Agency in England are responsible for dealing with coastal flooding and erosion, and they have budgets for this. But when you think about resilience, then you start to think about, well, actually, development policy, other government pots suddenly become relevant to resilience, but they are in different departments, and departments are very jealous of their budgets. And so you start to really, it actually starts you to question maybe the boundaries that are drawn in government, which I suppose bluntly, maybe government doesn't like that when you actually start to shine a light on some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it, once you start having this more systems approach, I think it just makes it a bit more complicated almost, because you need to get different departments and different people to collaborate who maybe aren't used to do so. Just something I wanted to clarify. So you've mentioned all these different factors that you took into account when coming up with a quantification method. But what is the unit of this coastal resilience index, and how do you actually, how do you combine different factors or data sets that have different units into one score?
At the end of the day, it's a score, so it hasn't got units really. So yeah, and then basically you measure them in the native units to start with, but then you have to move to a to a score for each unit thereafter, and then when you actually come up with an overall resilience, you've got to use weighting. So essentially, you're using a multi-criteria analysis. You're trying to compare apples, oranges, and pears, and so that's where the sort of the human values come in. Really, what do you at the end of the day, what do you think is important? I mean, there are other ways of doing this. Sometimes people try and monetize everything, for example. So you can try and reduce everything to one unit. So I mean, that monetization, that's what they're doing. But essentially, it's following the same process, because you put high monetary values on the things you think are important. So although I suppose there's a discipline there maybe of finances, so maybe that constrains the scores that you come up with. So we didn't monetize. We just had a weighting of the importance. And I mean, within the project, I mean, we actually sat down as a group and we just said, right, play act. Imagine you're an environmentalist. Imagine you're you're working in a local authority, etc. We took on different roles and we actually just scored. It was, again, when we're not saying the answer we've come up with is right, it's illustrative of what needs to happen, and we recognize it needs to be done much more widely if there's to be if this is to be applied in practice.
Okay. And in terms of this kind of resilience index that you came up with, so does this give a measure of coastal resilience in terms of kind of long-term sea level rise, or more in terms of the resilience to extreme events like storm surges, or does it take both into account?
Well, I think the notion of resilience hopefully would take into account both. You know, that's what we'd be aspiring to. So really, you know, you want to live through time. And so, and in time, you have long, slow changes like sea level rise, and you have shocks like storms. So you want to be able, your approach should be able to do both. What we did was actually come up with a snapshot of resilience today. We didn't really do time evolution. We did play with time evolution by using scenarios. So what, you know, so we did actually produce a map of the resilience of the coast of England today. And then if you start to think about scenarios, you can start to think about how that might affect the quantity. So you could start to explore how the world might evolve under different futures. But again, these were purely sort of illustrations of what might happen. And you could spend a huge amount of time just trying to do those kinds of simulations. We just illustrated that the approach would allow that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's good to know, because it might then be a tool also to evaluate or to compare different kind of policy options against each other.
Absolutely. Although, I mean, I would stress, I think we're talking here about operationalization.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of our comments would be there's probably quite a bit of work needs to go on beyond the Coast Res project to actually use it in anger, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wouldn't want people to think we had the answer at the end of this project. I think we had made important progress in understanding what needed to happen.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that you created a map of England, like showing the coastal resilience score for the different areas along the coast of England. But is the kind of methodology that you proposed, would that be applicable to other countries as well, or is it very specific to the UK or to England?
I think it could be adapted to anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. But it'll depend on what data exists. So in many places in the world where there's probably not very much monitoring, it might be difficult to apply it as we did it in the UK. But I think it would be applicable across Europe, but it would probably need to be adapted a little bit, because I think most countries have their own peculiarities of what they collect in terms of data, etc. So it would need to be adjusted. But I think it could be transferred across Europe and North America, Australia, New Zealand, for example. And then elsewhere in the world, the data varies. I think one of the comments I'd make, I've only really thought about this talking with you now, is actually Earth observation. So satellite-based measurements are becoming available globally at very high resolution. So that would be maybe an interesting avenue to think about how you might maybe try and populate a coastal resilience method with Earth observation data. Because then you could do that literally anywhere, because it would be a common data set that exists globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Coastal Res project was completed in 2020. So in the last 3 years since the completion, have you seen an evolution in terms of the way in which the UK is approaching coastal hazard management?
Oh, I think so. There's a whole suite of resilience projects funded by the Environment Agency. This is not just about coastal resilience, it's about resilience to flooding in general. And it's about £200 million, if I remember correctly, and about 20-odd projects, maybe 25 projects, that are looking at resilience in flooding. So I think that and around that, there's been quite a bit of conceptual work. I was involved with a couple of these, of the kind of conceptual aspect of the project. So I think you can see the thinking moving on into sort of practice. And I think I made the comment about the need to learn about what it means, and I think that's this is probably how you have to do it in practice, by actually implementing resilience, implementing innovative ideas in practice and seeing what is possible. I mean, I think probably in these projects, they're obviously working in a current policy environment, so they are very evolutionary, which was what we did in CoastRes. We were definitely building from what exists today, and mm-hmm. not trying to tear up and start again. In terms of how you would move forward. The other thing that's happened is there's been quite an interesting focus on coastal erosion, because we have two hazards on the coast, really, in the UK. We have flooding. I mean, more people are affected by flooding, but coastal erosion is a Pacific problem. And of course, if you can be flooded many times, but you can only be eroded once, if you like. Once your house has gone over the cliff, that's it. And so there are actually now some smaller but rather innovative projects looking at our cliff coasts and how you can live with erosion. And they're taking on board some of these ideas. And it's interesting how the notion of place making has come to the fore. And you see that in both flooding and erosion, that I suppose traditionally engineers drove these processes, and they often talked about the line, which was essentially a defense line, if you follow. And now the thought is much more about how do we build a place that people want to live, which is kind of getting more to the notion of resilience, you know, the resilience concept, really. And so in that world, in that placemaking, the defense is maybe an important part of it, but it's not the only thing that matters. And maybe there is no, and maybe in some cases there is no defense. On many of the eroding coasts, they're having to live with erosion, and it's not, and the defenses are not economically justifiable. So they're going to have to live with erosion. So placemaking is a question about how you live with a hazard, basically.
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying this, because it's a term that I've kind of seen pop up in quite a few documents related to coastal resilience, but I wasn't 100% sure what it meant. So thanks for clarifying that. And so you mentioned already the use of satellite data, but are there some other kind of key research gaps that would still need to be addressed when it comes to coastal adaptation, particularly when applied to the UK?
Well, I think, well, there are many questions, I think, looking ahead. And I think one of the big ones, the Climate Change Committee, this is a very focused one, really, but the Climate Change Committee has identified that there are a large number of areas where the shoreline management plans say we're going to hold the line. But if you apply the current rules to decide whether or not you can afford a scheme, you can't, when you take into account sea level rise. And the economic benefits don't justify the money you'd be required to spend. So there are, I mean, and I think this move towards a resilience framing placemaking is really implicitly trying to address this challenge by maybe reframing the problem a little bit. But there are some quite challenging problems down the road. I mean, technically, we can protect these areas, but that would mean increasing our budgets on coastal defence, and I think that's unlikely. To be honest, money seems to be pretty tight. So from a practical viewpoint, if anything, I would imagine the amount of money that's spent on these issues as a proportion of our economy we'd like to see probably fall, because you know, people, health, education, all these other priorities seem to be hungry for resources. So I think, you know, this issue of how we're going to manage probably the need to have less defenses on the coast is quite a fundamental challenge, which I think we're only beginning to grapple with, because it's maybe a few decades away, and the political cycle encourages maybe, you know, it's not in my term of office, which is one of the problems, but the day will come.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And finally, I just wanted to ask you, based on your experience, do you have any kind of practical advice for scientists or researchers who are really interested in using their research to help inform policy?
Oh, well, I think to inform policy, well, that's a good question. I think probably it's good for young people like yourself to actually maybe step away from their PhD a little bit. I think as you are with this process there where you're interviewing me, and actually talk to experts and also practitioners in areas that are of interest to them, and actually really see how are decisions made. What are the problems in the near future? Where are the difficult issues and questions that need to be grabbed hold of, and to really sort of see how the world works? Because I suppose in science we tend to pursue a rather maybe idealized and questions, and I think that's good. I think that's part of the training. But then to go out and look at the real world, and then you can sort of think, well, how can I translate what I'm doing into a way that might be more useful? So I think that engagement, and that seems to be encouraged. Many PhD programs now seem to have these 3-month sort of opportunities to do placements, etc. And I think that, you know, getting the right placement for your interests, I think, could be very eye-opening to your further work. Even if you stay in sort of pure research, I think you'll still understand better how that could be useful.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to participate in this podcast series. It's been really interesting to talk to you, and I've certainly learned a lot, and I'm sure the listeners will as well. I hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as I did. To hear more conversations like this, you can subscribe to the CSAP YouTube channel. You can also subscribe to the CSAP newsletter to get updates on a range of topics at the interface of science and policy. All the relevant links will be in the description of this YouTube video.